From Maine Public Radio and mainepublic.org, I'm Nicole Legrisco with the news on This Day in Maine, Monday, August 19th, 2024.
This Day in Maine is made possible by Now You're Cooking, celebrating 24 years of selling cookware, kitchen tools, gadgets, and fine wine on historic Front Street in downtown Bath, open 7 days a week.
Dozens of surfers converged on Higgins Beach in Scarborough today, chasing waves kicked up by Hurricane Ernesto. The National Weather Service issued a high surf advisory for much of southern and mid-coast Maine until 8 o'clock tonight. Jake Lawrence drove down from Warren with some friends and is trying surfing for the first time today.
It hurts a little bit. A little bit more than you'd expect. The water's got some power. Getting slammed all around.
Undeterred, Lawrence says his goal for the day is to get up on 2 feet. While Ernesto is not expected to make landfall in the U.S. or Canada, the National Hurricane Center is warning beachgoers up and down the East Coast to beware of high swells and potentially dangerous rip currents. The federal government has issued the nation's first floating offshore wind research lease to the state of Maine. The lease area covers about 15,000 acres and is located nearly 30 miles off the southern Maine coast. The site would have a dozen floating offshore wind turbines capable of generating up to 144 megawatts of renewable energy. But the main goal of the project is to study the floating wind turbine technology and how it interacts with the environment, the fishing industry, and other marine life. Construction is not expected to start for several years. The state of Maine must first propose and submit a plan detailing the research it would like to conduct at the site. And a new rule to limit solar arrays on farmland in Maine is attracting critics that claim it will delay the state's clean energy transition and hurt struggling farmers. Peter McGuire reports.
Under the regulation, solar developers would have to assess soil quality and pay a fee to offset its loss. That would affect about 13% of land in the state. But solar power advocates say the rule would make building more complicated and expensive. Julianne Smith from the Maine Farmers Coalition told regulators at a hearing Monday that discouraging solar projects could also hurt farmers looking for new revenue sources. Maine lost 7% of its farms in the last 5 years, most because they did not make enough money, Smith says.
If the solar project is going to save this farm versus it becoming housing, that should be included with those calculations.
Supporters of the measure say it will preserve valuable land as Maine sees farms dwindle at the same time the state tries to boost local food production. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Peter McGuire.
And the new owners of Orrington's idled waste-to-energy plant are starting a multi-phase reopening plan. Eagle Point Energy Center spokesperson Dan Cashman says the first step is to begin accepting waste, although energy production won't start until a later date.
So at this point, the idea of Eagle Point Energy Center opening as a waste-to-energy facility still exists. But in the interim, there's a phased-in approach where waste will be taken in from communities and private haulers.
The company has submitted a transfer station application to the Department of Environmental Protection. Cashman says that will allow it to dispose of waste at Juniper Ridge Landfill. In recent months, with the facility not accepting waste, towns have been transporting it to the Juniper Ridge Landfill separately. And Arista County is in the midst of a forest tent caterpillar outbreak, and this year it's damaged maple trees that are used to produce maple syrup. Michael Parisio, a forest entomologist with the Maine Forest Service, says most trees can sustain a couple years of defoliation, but
when you're actually extracting a resource like sap from sugar maples, you know, the defoliation can be a little bit more serious.
Parisio says the damage is on the Quebec border near St. Aurélie. He says the Forest Service will monitor the trees over the winter to get a sense of what next year's forest tent caterpillar population will look like. And a record number of breeding puffins were counted on Seal Island this year. Don Lyons, the director of conservation science at Audubon's Seabird Institute, says overall, Maine puffins had a normal, successful year, which is a relief. He says warm water temperatures and a lack of food have made it harder for chicks to survive in recent years and can make it difficult for puffins to persist in the Gulf of Maine in the future.
Certainly the record number at Seal Island of nesting puffins suggests that we're not there yet. There's warning signs, but we haven't faced kind of a permanent catastrophe as of yet.
Lyons says this has been a good food year for puffins. While typical food sources such as herring are low, he says a higher proportion of puffins' diet was devoted to invertebrates such as krill. And this weekend, visitors got a first look at a newly completed visitor center at the Katahdin Woods and Waters National Monument. The completion of the station is the result of an ongoing collaboration between the National Park Service, the Elliottsville Foundation, and the Wabanaki Nations to recognize Indigenous history and culture in the overall experience. Caitlin Badayan has more.
It's a foggy morning on Lookout Mountain when the first visitors of the day arrive at the Tagagabimuk contact station. With light wood inside and out, the building feels open to the surrounding woods and offers a direct line of sight to Mount Katahdin, which holds spiritual significance for the Wabanaki Nations. The architecture of the building incorporates a double curve design, a significant element to the Wabanaki Nations. The Bunawebskaik Singers, a Penobscot Nation drumming group, are the first to greet them at the Eastern Gathering Circle. This project has taken years of design and construction work, slowed by the pandemic, and driven by a unique partnership with the Wabanaki Nations.
It's amazing to have been involved from the very beginning and to see it all come to life after so much hard work and heart and soul is pretty incredible.
Jennifer Neptune, a citizen of the Penobscot Nation, is the lead exhibit writer for the station. She helped select some of the traditional Wabanaki stories that are shared inside the station on exhibit walls, some accompanied by audio recordings of the same stories spoken in Penobscot, while others include videos of the surrounding area.
You know, we really had to narrow it down to what most represented this place and the rivers and the land and you know, what happened here and what you can experience here as a visitor.
It's just one element of the exhibits that detail the Wabanaki Nation's connections to this land. The initial contact station designs were very different from what stands on the land today. The originals resembled a farmhouse and silo. But James Eric Francis Sr., the Penobscot Nation's Director of Cultural and Historic Preservation, says the representatives from the Wabanaki Nations objected, pointing out the design erased the area's indigenous history and instead emphasized the colonization of the region.
We saw early on that protecting our Wabanaki expressions needed to be attended to. So that was an important step. Like, it happened so early that it felt like a true collaboration, not this 11th hour consulting that often happens.
Francis is one of the representatives on the Wabanaki Advisory Board that worked on the project. The group worked not just on the building, but on the exhibits inside, commissioning several pieces from Wabanaki artists. The result is a building that is deeply embedded with the Wabanaki culture and history. The building is meant to orient visitors to the variety of views in every direction, with tall windows and balconies. That extends down to the floor, where Francis designed a map of the Penobscot watershed, which is etched into the concrete tiles.
Well, one of the things that we really wanted to do was understand that we wanted visitors to understand where they were in the landscape. We really wanted them grounded. It's a very important place that we sit here.
Integral to the project is that the Wabanaki Nations maintain the intellectual property rights to the information shared and how the National Park Service can use it. Altogether, it's a unique endeavor, says U.S. Interior Secretary Deb Haaland, the first Native American to serve in a cabinet position. Haaland, who is a member of the Pueblo of Laguna, traveled to see the station for herself on Saturday.
It is extraordinary, not only in the what, a beautiful space, but in the how. This is the result of a deliberative and collaborative effort with tribal nations to fully honor the traditions, languages, images, kinship, and ancestral representations of these lands' original stewards.
That collaboration extends to the name. In Penobscot, Tagagabimuk means as far as one can see. And Jennifer Neptune says it's a perfect description.
Because throughout this process, we were looking as far as we could see back to honor our ancestors that were here before us, and as far into the future as we could see to make sure that what we were doing and what we were creating and what we were leaving behind could speak to future generations.
The National Park Service will announce normal visiting hours in the coming months, but the station will remain closed for now as finishing touches are completed. But the Wabanaki Advisory Board will continue work and plans to hold trainings for park rangers and begin an ethnographic study on the Wabanaki Nation's history in the area. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Caitlin Bedayan.
And that's today's Maine News. For more stories, visit mainepublic.org. Coming up on Maine Calling at 11 o'clock tomorrow morning, we'll hear about opportunities for learning later in life here in Maine. I'm Nicole LaGrisco. Thanks for listening.